Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight, we're going to be hearing from the Republican nominee for President of the U.S., Donald Trump. This hour, we're going to be hearing from Sam Tannenhaus, former editor of the New York Times Book Review, contributing writer for the Times Now, and author of The Death of Conservatism, who recently wrote about how Trump can save the GOP. Sam writes, it's a party with a long history of cultural populism, hatred of elites combined with direct appeals to the forgotten man, the silent majority, the moral majority, but it's grown curiously deaf, he writes, the authentic distress still troubling millions who've been struggling in the Obama years. Later, David Frum will be with us, senior editor at The Atlantic and chair of the Policy Exchange. He was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He writes in The Atlantic that there is no conservative future without Trump's voters. How to deliver them solutions that will improve their lives is important. Frum agrees with George Will that the Trump nomination represents an institutional failure, but he says the Republican Party is ill and quitting, as Will did, won't help. An American political party can only be reformed from within. So we have a lot to talk about this hour, the last day of the Republican National Convention, a wild night at the convention last night. I'm sure you heard or saw. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Sam and David. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Sam. Thanks so much for being with us.
Kathleen, good to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Really an insightful article you wrote. Let's start with what I just was talking about and you wrote about, that the Republican Party has grown curiously deaf to the authentic distress troubling millions. What is that distress, and why are the Republicans deaf to it?
Well, Kathleen, I think there are several kinds. Some of it is economic, we know. This has been a slow recovery. It's been a recovery, but it's a slow one, and it's helping people mainly at the top. Now, that is not to say all of Donald Trump's supporters are at, economically speaking, the bottom. They're all over the place, which leads to a different kind of dislocation or anxiety, and that's a cultural change in the country. And much of it is demographic, as we know. In the next 10 to 15 years, this country will not be majority white any longer. Mm-hmm. And is that a big deal? Is that something most people worry about? Probably not. But with that come these kind of, impressions people have, or sensations that the country isn't really theirs so much anymore. And Donald Trump is someone who speaks to that more directly than other Republicans do.
Mm-hmm. You write about, and let's go back in history a little bit. We don't have to go too far back. You write about Sanders and Trump making the case that free trade policies have moved our jobs, our wealth, our factories, while the special interests are still doing just fine, thank you. But there was a time, and you cite certain administrations, when there was a left-right fusion. What were those times, and what should we learn from them?
Well, two periods I mentioned were Republican eras, that is, eras when there were Republican presidents, but actually Democratic majorities in Congress. And some of your listeners will remember that until fairly recently, Democrats almost always controlled Congress, from the New Deal all the way up through the Gingrich Revolution in 1994. It was really Democrats who most of the time controlled Congress and worked out fairly effective compromises with Republicans, because the two parties were not so ideologized as they are now. So the two presidents that I emphasize were Republicans, Eisenhower and Nixon, who belonged together anyway because Nixon had been Eisenhower's vice president. They were both Republicans who came out of the center of the party, Eisenhower more clearly than Nixon, but Nixon was never really trusted on the right. You know, we have a memory of him as a polarizing figure, which he was, as Donald Trump now is. But actually, in his policies and governance, he was very much in the middle and sometimes kind of to the left. Eisenhower was the same. So what happened was compromises got worked out on the basis of what seemed to be majority concerns. And that's really what's been kind of pulled out of our politics.
And you say that Nixon could provide the best template for Trump. Do you think that a Trump presidency could follow in Nixon's line, taking, you know, hiring people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan to look at urban policy, becoming a party that really looked at what's ailing those who have not recovered from the recession?
Well, in a thought experiment way, which is what this essay that we're talking about was, yes. Now, there are very clear differences. Nixon was a true political professional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was elected to Congress in 1946 when he was, 33 years old, and he was a politician for the rest of his life, and he knew how the system worked. Donald Trump, we know, although he's long had connections to politics and politicians, comes at it all very differently. So those are differences. Nixon also was something of a maestro, if not of domestic policy, then of foreign policy. Henry Kissinger, who worked for Nixon, told me once that Richard Nixon was the only first-rate strategic thinker who ever occupied the presidency in all his years. And Dr. Kissinger has known presidents from Eisenhower on. And he said this was the first truly strategic thinker. Is Donald Trump a strategic thinker in that way? Well, we don't have a ton of evidence. However, what Trump does have is an almost boredom or indifference with checklist ideology. And there he's like Nixon. The opposite of Trump, we heard last night, Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz speaks almost like a lawyer. You know, I tell people he should be running for president of the Federalist Society and not for the United States, because he's a brilliant lawyer who's argued cases before the Supreme Court, and he's very good at reciting because he's memorized a lot of it, the sort of touchstones of conservative ideology. The fact is, that's got almost nothing to do with the problems that need to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
Trump comes in, and he doesn't know all the ideology, but he thinks he knows people. We forget his sister is a quite liberal judge, you know, for all the talk about replacing Justice Scalia with someone on the right and all the kind of warnings about the dangers of presidents and what appointments they would make. Trump's own sister is a quite liberal judge. So Trump has an odd kind of elasticity there. That's what conservatives don't like about him, but that's actually what, in theory, could make him a plausible leader.
Mm. Let's talk about what E.J. Dionne has called Trump's politics of flippant brutality. Coming on the scene, saying Barack Obama was not born in the United States, making comments about Mexicans and Muslims and Ted Cruz's father and his wife and so many others. How does that play into that, into this, what we've been talking about, those people who have been disaffected? Are they also embracing this kind of flippancy, these cruel remarks?
Well, I would say yes and no. I'd look at it two ways, which is, one, we forget how often we make extenuations for people we like and know. No matter where we are in the ideological spectrum, we kind of cut slack for people we think are okay. So if you like Donald Trump and Donald Trump does something outrageous like this, your reaction may be, you know what, I kind of wish he hadn't said that. But he doesn't really mean anything by it either. And I think that, not to say that's what I think, but this is possibly the way someone might react to him, which means that there's a broader thing going on, which is this phrase we're hearing constantly now, this fixation on political correctness. And I think especially for a lot of older voters, and hey, I'm 60 years old, so I do not mean to say that in a condescending way. And also for some quite young voters, and we're beginning to hear something from them, the group called the alt-right, the alternative right. Now, look, some of this goes into really nasty territory. You know, we're talking about anti-Semitism and worse,
mm-hmm.
or equivalent. But in a more general way, if you talk to just a perfectly normal, sane person who happens to like Donald Trump, as some of my neighbors out here and friends in that town in Connecticut where I live are, what they'll say is, you know what, there is so much political correctness abroad in the land that people feel inhibited. What used to be an innocent comment is now a microaggression, right? And so people think they're not allowed to speak as freely as they once did. And Trump comes along and he says all these things that we don't really even want to hear people say, but maybe there's some part of it that thinks, you know what, it's not really the end of the world when he says it. And I think that explains some of that, not all of it, because in some cases, yes, it's anger and hostility and prejudice and bigotry and much else besides. But I think in some instances, people just think, all right, Trump should, you know, put a zipper on it, right? Or he should think before he talks, but he doesn't really mean all that ill when he says these things.
Does he have, some Democrats particularly have suggested, present a grave danger to the Republic should he be elected?
Well, you know, it's hard to argue with a point like that because we don't know what those dangers might be, except in the most theoretical way. Listen, there are many conservatives who say the same about Hillary Clinton. And you think, well, wait a minute, you know, this is a highly educated person who's been through all the different issues and many of the crises of our time. She's as qualified, as President Obama said, she may be the most qualified non-incumbent who's ever run for office or in the modern era, and yet there are people who are persuaded she's dangerous. The problem with that is it creates a language, a vocabulary of danger and peril. And I understand why some are worried about Donald Trump. For instance, there's a powerful story in the New Yorker magazine this week by Jane Mayer, brilliant investigative journalist, who interviewed Tony Schwartz, who was the ghostwriter for Trump's famous book, The Art of the Deal. And according to this story, and no one seems able or even interested in disproving it, it was Tony Schwartz who wrote every word of it. Well, he says this man really is a sociopath, that he has no attention span, he has no interest in anything other than himself. He's someone whose finger you wouldn't want near the nuclear button. Is that possibly true? Yeah, maybe it is.
When you write in your piece that Trump has said this is called the Republican Party, it's not called the Conservative Party, how was it made by Paul Ryan and others into a conservative party, and what is Trump breaking from when he, and what are the differences in the definition of a Republican Party or a conservative party?
Great question, because that is really what my article was about. And just so listeners aren't confused, my essay, Kathleen and I are talking about, is not a defense of Donald Trump or an endorsement of his presidency. What it's really about is the bind the Republican Party got itself into by making itself so much the vehicle of an ideology. For instance, George Will, who many people respect and admire, myself included, his book on statecraft, soulcraft, is a glorious little classic of our era about the responsibilities of politics. He's a fine columnist and, you know, often brilliant writer. But when he says the Republican Party is in danger of losing its identity as a conservative party, the conservative party that was kind of created by Barry Goldwater, well, there are a couple of things there we want to keep in mind. First, we're a two-party system. We're not a two-ideology system. We're not a liberal and conservative system. We're a two-party system. And historically, the parties have had mixes and blends of legislators and representatives, tribunes who are presidents, and voters. And voters are the people being overlooked most in all this conversation. Well, so when George Will says he wants the Republican Party to be a conservative party, he means a really specific thing, and he tells us it was the party Barry Goldwater helped create in 1964 when he lost very badly to Lyndon Johnson, but also succeeded in supplanting the East Coast establishment, as it was called, the Kingmakers, the moderates, with sort of Sun Belt, West Coast ideological conservatives. Well, I think at this stage, when we look back at what Goldwater wrought, what came afterward, that's a pretty mixed bag at best. It's what gave us the war in Iraq. It's what gave us a good deal of the income inequality we have now because of changes in approaches to social welfare policy, to urban policy, to tax policy. Are these really the things we want to go back to now? If you talk to a brilliant young policy person like Yuval Levin, the editor of the National Affairs magazine, or Ramesh Panuru, the columnist for National Review and Bloomberg Views, you know, both of whom have no use for Trump, just to make this clear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they will tell you that Reagan-style economic policy is now irrelevant. You cannot do that anymore. It has no meaning for anybody. There's no reason to be cutting taxes anymore. There's no reason to be increasing the burden on the poor and the middle class and the working class. Well, that's what Congressman Ryan might well do if he had his druthers. We've seen what his proposals are like. We've heard for how many years now that he and his allies will repeal the evil Obamacare, and yet they haven't given us a plausible replacement for it, although one has been promised. So what does that mean? Some 20 million people lose health insurance? Would the country really allow that at this point? Well, that's the ideal conservative party George Will seems to be talking about. And I just don't think it's valid anymore. And that's what happened. That language, we heard it last night from Senator Cruz, the endless talk about freedom without ever saying what freedom really is, or saying freedom means or includes my right to decide who goes in what bathroom and what doesn't, and when women have to give a birth to children they don't want. Suddenly freedom looks like something else, right? Because all of us know or have faith in certain freedoms we want to protect and others we want to curtail. So to use the all-purpose word freedom means nothing. And this is the problem with Cruz-style conservatism. It's filled with these buzzwords. They're essentially slogans. It's sloganeering that does the work that ideas and policy need to. It's hollow and empty. That's why when Donald Trump came along and says in those sort of Molly Bloom-like fractured sentences of his
right,
that we're going to take care of the poor people and we'll have a great health insurance program. We'll do it the way they do up in Canada. And we're sick of all the rich guys on Wall Street who push paper and don't pay taxes. That Trump was actually connecting in a powerful way to the voters who for decades now have been supporting the Republican Party and getting nothing in return.
Yeah, interesting. He sure is connecting. Sam Tannenhouse is with us, the first part of the show. We have time for a few phone calls for him. We're talking about a piece that he wrote recently in the New York Times, that Sunday, I call it Sunday Review, but it's Week in Review now. He's former editor of the New York Times Book Review, author of The Death of Conservatism, a contributing writer for the New York Times now, and the piece was on how Trump can save the GOP. Our number is 800-486-8655. We'll be with your calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for you, Sam. Scott in Oshkosh. Hi.
Good afternoon. My comment is, and I hope this goes along with the theme of your show, that I believe that if Donald Trump is elected, and I'm a proclaimed moderate Democrat, and I, in a strange way, hope that he does. But I see that the president, Donald Trump presidency, would be either very good for the country or, on the flip side, very destructive. I see it as a black and white thing, that there's not going to be a whole lot in the middle with him. But I'm still waiting to hear conversations or statements from candidates about what they're going to do to unite people, and not just empty phrases, bringing the two sides together and blah, 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 but specifically what they're going to do. In Trump's case, it's going to be to unite the Republican Party, but what specifically to bridge the gaps between mm-hmm. the two parties right now is what I keep listening for, and I just don't hear it.
Don't hear it. Yeah, it's a good thought question. Sam?
Yeah, and it's absolutely true. And, because I approach this, historically, I wish I had an answer. What I would point out is that, first of all, I really agree with the caller that you have this black and white possibility, an either or with him. And it reminds me of something that Norman Mailer, the great author, said, you know, back in 19... Yeah. Sorry?
No, we're here.
Oh.
Yeah, we're hearing something way back in the distance. I don't know what it is, Sam.
In 1968, and even earlier when he was writing about John F. Kennedy in 1960, Mailer wrote some brilliantly sort of prescient and intuitive political journalism, said that one of the things that Americans have to be willing to do, and at times seem willing to do, is to take enormous risks. That's part of what the country is about, is risk. And we kind of like the idea. He was actually thinking of John F. Kennedy, who was this very young guy who did not have much experience. But, you know, he had a lot more than Donald Trump, right? 14 years in the House and Senate, but hadn't really done very much. Tremendously glamorous, kind of famous family and all the rest. But nobody really knew just how solid a figure he was. And Mailer said that's actually what we like about him, that we can project onto him some idea of what a new young president might be like. Well, Donald Trump isn't young. We know that. Always worth remembering, if he gets elected, he will be the oldest person ever elected to that office.
Oh, will he really?
Yeah, huh. He'll be older than Ronald Reagan. Hillary Clinton will be just behind. She's slightly younger than Reagan. So it's odd in this age of millennials we have these two much older people. Well, at any rate, this sense of the unknowable with Trump is, I think, one reason people like him. There's something unpredictable about him. That also, of course, when you're talking about, you know, the nuclear football and all the rest, can be very scary. And so that is a question. As for uniting the two parties, what he might conceivably do is, because he just has no interest in the talking points, and he's so committed, we think, or at least he says, to getting things done, to pushing through legislation or bills of some kind, it's not inconceivable that he could find a way, at least in policy terms, to get some people to make concessions and agree about things. But now here's the black side of that, or the negative side. This is something I wanted to write about in the Times piece, but there wasn't space and it wasn't quite the moment for it. Then someone came along, not David Frum, but someone else in the Atlantic, created this scenario, which is that if Donald Trump wins, presumably then the Republicans will control the House and the Senate as well. And it may actually be Speaker Ryan who is writing our policy. And Trump may think, well, they've got majorities there, and Paul Ryan is a policy wonk, which I, Donald Trump, am not, so I'll just go along with all of this. To me, that's the bigger concern, because I'm not a fan of that kind of supply-side policy. I think we've seen enough of it. I think we know it did its business. It doesn't work anymore. So that could be a problem. If, by some chance, Donald Trump stumbled through and Democrats got control of one of the two houses, you know, the two chambers, or in this age of what Francis Fukuyama calls the vetocracy, if a group are able to stop legislation from going through, it might actually force compromise, that Trump is going to be better positioned than some other presidents would to solve, because he has no ideological commitments. He doesn't have a base that thinks of him as a progressive or thinks of him as a conservative. They just voted for him, took a flyer on him, because he was a guy who maybe could get things done.
Oh, what a time this is. It's going to be fascinating. I hope you'll write more and you'll join us again, Sam. Thank you so much.
Kathleen, it was great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Sam Tannenhaus, former editor of the New York Times Book Review. He's now a contributing writer and he's the author of The Death of Conservatism. David Frum is joining us now, and I think that David has been in Cleveland. We'll find out in a moment. He wrote a very interesting piece in The Atlantic. I'm still a Republican, and I'll fight to reclaim my party. David was a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, and he writes a very thoughtful article as well. For those of you who have called in, your phone calls will still be applicable to this half hour, so please just stay on the line, and we'll be with you, I promise, momentarily. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-486-8655. Hi, David.
Hey there.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Are you at the convention?
I am.
Oh, you are.
Greetings from Cleveland.
Thank you very much, where things are kind of wild.
I bought a button from a vendor that said, Cleveland, it's not so bad.
I'm sure it's not so bad. Cleveland's okay, you know, Midwest, it's okay. Your piece is really interesting. Let's start with Paul Ryan, because, of course, he's from Wisconsin, and he's trying to hold things together in a way last night. But you write about his ideological radicalism from 2009 to 2015 that pushed the party in directions making it unelectable at the presidential level. What were those directions?
After the defeat exit of the last Republican administration, and after the big wins in 2010, and after the Tea Party explosion in the summer of 2009, the Republican Party committed itself to big, immediate cuts in government spending, in healthcare programs, and then over the longer term, pretty substantial reduction in retirement security programs, Social Security and Medicare. And this was to finance some very large tax cuts. I mean, all of this was done also in a very confrontational way, threats to shut down the government, even default on U.S. obligations if Republicans didn't get their way, presented in an apocalyptic tone. We were at the tipping point. If we didn't act at this very moment, that things would be over forever for the United States. And at the same time, Republicans were insisting on, were fighting financial reforms, and they were demanding as their brainwave as to how to broaden their party's base, a comprehensive immigration reform that would have doubled the already very, very high levels of immigration into the United States. The United States takes about 1 million immigrants a year legally, but another 750,000 probably arrive illegally. The immigration reform plans that began to circulate in 2013 would have doubled the legal flow to about 2 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this was done without much regard for the bread-and-butter income concerns of middle-class and working Americans. And the result was the party found that the leadership had moved to a place where the membership did not follow, would not be found, and that created a void. Into that void stepped Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, it's so interesting to me that it's something that was missed by the Republicans. It was also missed by the Democrats, really. It took Bernie Sanders to get that issue front and center, and it was obvious to Republicans and Democrats that everybody had that issue as front and center. How could, if you want to call them the elites of both parties, miss that?
Well, we have, the years since 2010 have been quite good for people at the top of the income distribution. So the progress since the Great Recession has been more visible if you belong to some of the better off groups. Second, on the immigration issue specifically, there's just an overwhelming elite consensus in favor of immigration. I mean, it even to question it makes you an unacceptable person. And I don't want to reduce everything to economics, but there's an economic dimension too. The way immigration works economically, most studies show that immigration confers our present immigration policies confer a small, very small net benefit on the United States. It's not that big a factor in the aggregate for the American economy. But the way you get that small net benefit is by totaling two enormous numbers, a huge benefit to people in the top third of the population, offset by a slightly less huge detriment to people in the bottom third of the population. So you net out these two gigantic swings, you get a relatively small total impact. But you can understand that the people in the bottom third think of immigration as a calamity, and people in the top third, a blessing. Because one group is so dramatically benefited, and the other group is so dramatically harmed.
Yeah. You write about George Will and his decision to leave the party. Your piece is titled, I'm Still a Republican, and I'll Fight to Reclaim My Party. Why did you, because I know you have concerns about Donald Trump, why are you still a Republican, and how will you go about, and how do those who share your viewpoint reclaim your party?
Well, I'm still a Republican because I believe it's the party that does the better job of upholding things I believe in most, America's strong role in the world. It's the party that is most committed to accepting to make to entrepreneurship and individual achievement. It's the party that is more cautious about major social experiments and understands better what in American life needs to be conserved and is generally more suspicious of dramatic changes. So I'm for all of those things. What I mean by saying I'm going to stay a Republican is, unlike George Will, a man I respect enormously and whose decisions, you know, I sort of articulate in that article, and they're serious decisions, they're serious motives. I'm remaining a registered Republican. I continue to take part in many party activities. I'm involved with a group called the Republican Jewish Coalition. I'm on the board. You know, I continue to admire and support many individual down-ballot candidates. I don't think it happens that when the party makes a presidential nomination, that that closes all questions and that that person becomes like, you know, the group commander and everybody, you know, like, or the, you know, the samurai king, and every other samurai has to follow him to battle no matter what stupid thing he proposes. Donald Trump is won't make a good president. He's certainly not a good nominee. I don't feel any obligation to pretend otherwise. And I think what Ted Cruz did last night, he's gotten a lot of criticism for it, I think was the noblest act of his public career.
Really?
And by the way, exactly, he said it, and so elegantly done. He said exactly the right thing in exactly the right way.
Hmm. So was there somebody who understood what a lot of the Republican base who've been supportive of Trump, was there somebody else who spoke to those same concerns?
No.
There was nobody.
No, there was not. And that's why Trump was successful. So what the people who are more modern and moderate in style, like Jeb Bush and John Kasich, were quite indifferent to having a set of policies and issues that were relevant to middle-class America. The people who were had a better complex of issues for middle-class America tended to be people who were very emphatically religious in a country that is rapidly becoming much less committed to organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
So if the place to be was to have a middle-class agenda and to be an essentially secular person. And that's where Donald Trump positioned himself. He is clearly the most secular Republican in a long, long time. And he at least purported to have a middle-class agenda on trade and immigration. And there are many good elements to that agenda. It's just the problem with his agenda is it's like the old joke about the Plotkin diamond. The Plotkin diamond is a beautiful diamond that comes with a terrible curse, and the curse is Mr. Plotkin. So with Donald Trump, I mean, you get he offered an agenda that was promising in many ways, but it came with Mr. Trump.
Yeah. Could you just explain to me, because I, for the life of me, can't quite get this, the persona of Donald Trump, the brutal things that he says, the untruths that he's started his whole thing with Barack Obama and being born in another country and going on and on with that when it obviously wasn't true and he must have known that. What he said about Ted Cruz's father, what he said about Megyn Kelly, all of that. There's just this nastiness, crudeness, that I don't know how people overlook all of that, even if he may appeal to them on economic grounds. What about all these other grounds? How does that not dismiss him?
The secret of Trump's appeal was not so much his issues, but that he seemed to be this dominant, powerful figure at a time when many Americans feel that society is spinning out of control and that things they'd relied on are dissolving. He would perform these little rituals of humiliation of other people on the stage. I mean, Jeb Bush was a leading target. And those other and his targets would then comply. You know, remember when he would give Jeb Bush compliments and Jeb Bush would accept them. Jeb Bush would demand that Donald Trump apologize to his wife. Donald Trump would mock him,
right,
and Jeb Bush would step down. So Trump showed himself again and again a strong figure. And people who are anxious want to believe their country is in the hands of decisive, confident leaders. Well, that's not what Trump is, as we've seen at this convention. Trump is a terrible manager. He can't run anything. And the people around him are boneheads. But he was able to play on TV the part of a confident manager, a decisive leader. And anxious people understandably responded.
But he was also a bully.
Yeah, well, I think that's another word for the same thing.
Okay. Let's welcome phone calls for you, David. David Frum is with us this part of the program. He wrote a piece in The Atlantic. I'm still a Republican, and I'll fight to reclaim my party. We'll put this piece, if we haven't already, on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Well worth reading, along with Sam Tannenhaus's piece. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. David is a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He is a senior editor at The Atlantic and chair of the Policy Exchange. His piece is I'm Still a Republican and I'll Fight to Reclaim My Party. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls. I didn't want to spend the whole half hour on this because what happened last night at the convention, David did respond to Cruz's comments and praised him for what he said. Do you think that, I'll ask this of the audience, that it was a bright and shining moment for Ted Cruz last night, or did you see it as something else? And what about the anger that erupted last night? We'll be interested in hearing your response. Let's go to phone calls for David and Tom and Spencer, our first caller. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. Good afternoon, Mr. Frum. I don't watch all of the conventions every year, but I did watch this one, and I wanted to get your guest's opinion on the fear-mongering, and it just seems like there's a general hatred for people coming from the convention, and I was wondering if this is unusual or if there is historical precedent to this or not.
Okay, well, to the caller. First, this is perhaps the least emotionally intense convention I've ever attended.
Really?
And since 1984, I've attended, I think, all but one Republican convention and all but two or three of the Democratic conventions. I've attended a lot of conventions. And they always have a mood. The mood here is listless. So whatever you're seeing on your TV screen, I had a conversation with a delegate after, I guess, the second night. Somebody I knew a little bit. We walked out together. So around Western State, and I said, how are you doing? And he said, I'm okay. And I said, so what are you going to do? And I guess I'll have to vote for him. And I said, really? And your wife? Oh, no. And your kids? No, they're registered as Democrats. There's just a kind of deflation everywhere. So, but what is true, here's what is true and what the caller is responding to. There is astonishingly little enthusiasm for this nominee. Only 38% of Republicans, according to the latest NBC poll, are satisfied with Donald Trump. There's no agenda at all. There are no pioneers. You've seen that yourself, and they have nothing to offer. So how do you hold these people together who really don't, many of whom, almost two-thirds of them, don't think Donald Trump should be president? You do it by trying to convince them that the alternative is even worse.
Absolutely.
You have to mobilize that emotion, because if it's not true that Hillary Clinton is radically, terribly unacceptable, then you have to face the fact that most people here, certainly the majority of Republicans in the country and probably many of the delegates here, do not believe that Donald Trump is well-suited for the job he's seeking and don't hear an agenda they like very much.
But when it comes to Hillary Clinton, lock her up. There's a lot of enthusiasm for that, I thought.
Well, the thing is, that's so, in a way, the preposterous and outrageous overstatement of that's actually a tell about how phony that emotion is, right? When you're really revved up, you can make jokes about your opponent, right? At the 2000 convention in Philadelphia, Dick Cheney gave a very funny speech, and we had this great line of it, Bill Clinton, as the man from hope goes home to New York, and everybody burst into laughter. They were done with Bill Clinton. They were mad at him, but they could also laugh at him. They didn't have to say these strident things because they didn't have to sort of work themselves into a mood in order to swallow a pill they didn't want to swallow.
Thanks very much, Tom, for your call. Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I would say the chanting about Hillary, lock her up and Chris Christie was guilty. I was laughing at it. It reminded me of a Monty Python skit from the Holy Grail, saying, burn the witch, she's a witch, I want to bring up the Ted Cruz thing.
If you're in the hall, you see, this is where TV, well, these things are done for TV, so anyway, TV is more real than being in the hall, but you also miss things. So what you see is that this is being organized. And there are a couple hundred people who are involved, and they're very close to the cameras.
Oh, really?
And meanwhile, back there, I mean, but there are like 4,500-plus delegates here, and most of them are doing their upwards moves. You know, the whole Utah delegation, it's like their mantra, you know, the slogan, Never Trump, their mantra seems to be never clap. They sit in the back staring glumly at everybody. When you move off the floor into the bank of seats, what normally happens is the floor is filled with delegates and alternates and important friends. And then just behind that, because these are in hockey arenas or basketball arenas, they're boxes where the biggest donors are. But then there's this bank of the best, what would normally be the best seats at a hockey game, where people have given generously, or, you know, the TV cameras. And those are like two-thirds empty. Huh. I mean, it really is. Now, that may be different tonight when Donald Trump speaks, but this, if you're thinking this is a seething mass of angry conservative humanity, that is really not true. It is a desultory mass of kind of disappointed and depressed humanity, 200 of whom are mobilized to jump around near the camera.
And who's in? Somebody's mobilizing those people?
They are. The floor manager. So Paul Manafort, who's Trump's floor manager here,
right.
who, by the way, admits to that he organized the booing of Ted Cruz, which was just...
Oh, he
I
does?
Mean, it doesn't get... He gave an interview to Robert Costa of the Washington Post, and he was sort of like, well, I couldn't possibly comment on that, but in the kind of knowing way, like it was my idea. And you just read this thing, and you think... You've just created this utterly destructive image of your convention that is going to hurt you, and you think you did something smart and you're proud of it. There are floor managers. There always are floor managers. They try to create impressions of enthusiasm. And look, it's always hard to create enthusiasm at a convention, always, because delegates are old.
Right.
You know, at least in their 40s, typically in their 50s, many in their 60s, not a few in their 70s, and some in their 80s. They do not dance normally and spontaneously dance around.
Yeah.
So if you want to have people dancing around, you bring in young volunteers, and you get your most enthusiastic people, and you bring them to the floor. You arrange your seating that way. That's how conventions are managed.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dave, for the call. Josh in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I was hoping the caller could comment on, I still hear a fair number of Sanders supporters talk about how they hate Hillary and they're still listening for Donald Trump. And what do you think it is in that group of voters who, on the one hand, say that they believe in the message of a rigged economy and a rigged system for the top 1%, but then can turn around and say, oh, well, maybe I'll believe somebody from that top 1% and go with what they say when they're going to fix my problem? What's going on there?
Well, I won't pretend to have a good answer to that. First, it's not my culture, the Democratic Party, so there's a lot of it that I don't read very well. I'm assuming, just based on stuff I read and hear from people who are more knowledgeable, that most Bernie supporters will gravitate back to their party nominee. There may be some resistance. Some of these people I do know, and some of the more intense, more passionate, more radical, more personally bitter, sometimes Sanders supporters may resist. But it does look, from everything we've seen, as if Hillary Clinton is doing a better job unifying her party around her than Donald Trump has been able to do unifying his party around him.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about political parties and political change. In your piece, you say, to effect sustained political change, you have to build broad coalitions. And certainly the Republicans were relying on Tea Party Republicans for what their policies were going to be, for what legislation they were going to champion. It hasn't worked out well.
Well, look, this is a vast country, 330 or so million people. In a presidential election, you get 125 million people voting. The biggest show on cable TV, The O'Reilly Factor, gets about 2 million viewers a night. Sometimes maybe it edges closer toward 3. Almost never gets over 3. So 3 out of 125 million leaves quite a lot of people over. So you just have to always remember that your core base of support is highly unrepresentative of the country as a whole. And parties are entities to mobilize people on a bigger scale. Parties are weaker than they used to be, and that allows relatively smaller groups of highly committed people to try to take them over and reshape the party. But those groups of people can very quickly lose sight of just how many Americans don't follow along with them. And those large numbers of Americans then can then just go AWOL, can drop out of the political process except on voting day, and parties can be stranded in places where they make themselves unelectable. And you can see this happening. We are seeing the struggles of the British Labour Party, where they've gathered around a completely unelectable person whom they can't get rid of. And we've seen there are plenty of American examples of this as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Donald Trump can be elected president, David?
Well, it's certainly possible. Look, he's the second most likely person on Earth to be the next president of the United States, so that's already
right.
Pretty good.
Right.
But yeah, I have to say, it does look like not a 50-50 chance. It doesn't look like a 60-40 chance. Is it a 90-10 chance or an 80-20 chance? That I can't say. But what I would say is, let's say it is a 90-10 chance. The next time you get on a plane, they tell you the plane has a 10% chance of crashing. You're not going to feel good. Oh, wow, that nine right. chances out of 10 that I arrive on time, I arrive in one piece. A 10% chance of a dangerous outcome is a very high number.
Let's go to Carolyn next in Winona. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I was just going to say that it's interesting. It reminds me of sort of what the Brits did to themselves, where you end up in a pickle, but you didn't really intend to be there. And I listened to a really interesting show this morning on your radio station, and they asked questions like, what happens when Donald Trump tries to do what he suggested, which is kill all the families of the ISIS members, and the U.S. military refuses to do it because it's illegal, or those kind of situations in which he doesn't know what he's doing, and the other administrators and the agencies in the government have to do a work around him. Why on earth have this incompetent person there? And so the speaker that was representing the Trump campaign said, well, there's always the vice president. Trump will be the figurehead, and then you'll have the vice president who actually makes the decisions. This is nuts.
David.
Yeah, that's not, I would agree with the call, that's not a really good plan. Vice presidents don't, you know, there's a Will Ferrell sketch in which Will Ferrell is explaining the role of the vice president as the most important figure in the U.S. government. The president can do nothing without the permission and the consent.
Right, right.
but that's not, in fact, how the system works. I agree with the call. The Trump presidency raises many, many frightening possibilities. That's why this party here is in such a state, because Republicans see them too. That's why only 38% of Republicans say they're satisfied.
Hmm. So what about Mike Pence? Was he warmly received? He was certainly Midwest values, and a lot of Midwest values. Very homespun.
There was much. Warm enough. First,
warm
he started
enough.
Awfully late, but the Trump campaign had done something else. It was. That looked like a good idea when they did it, but it rapidly became clear it was not a good idea, which is they gave the typical vice president speech is a party unifying speech. The nominee gives a big national address with, you know, broad themes, tries to reach people who might otherwise not be wanting to vote for the national ticket. The number two person, they typically nail down the coalition. They speak to the right or to the left, depending on the party, and really button them up. Donald Trump Jr. gave that speech. He gave the orthodox Republican speech, ticking off all the boxes of Republicans' favorite issues. He acted as if he were the running mate. And he got a very good response, a very warm response, one of the warmest of the whole week. But he did it. And then, so when Mike Pence did it again, he did it less effectively. And people had sort of had that. They'd already had their taste of, you know, and we're going to do all the things that Republicans typically, you know, school choice and all the things that Republicans care about, protect the Second Amendment. Pence did it again, and he was actually a less effective communicator than Donald Trump Jr., and because he spent so much time introducing himself and telling us
right.
about himself, that he didn't leave, that it was well past 11 o'clock in the East before he got to the part where he started talking about the things that people in the hall might be interested in.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, have a good time tonight.
Well, it's history. How
I know it is.
It, right?
It's amazing to watch it. Thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll be with us again before we vote.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. David Frum, our guest. And this last half hour of the program, he's senior editor at The Atlantic. His latest piece is I'm Still a Republican, and I'll Fight to Reclaim My Party. We'll have it on our Facebook page, along with Sam Tannenhaus's article from The New York Times. which looks at how the Republicans kind of missed what was going on, as David's article does as well, this economic angst that so many members of the party and members of the Democratic Party as well actually are experiencing, and the party elites, can we call them that, failed to grasp. So, David is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he is a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting show, and to Kiri Salinas for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Just a reminder, we are carrying the Republican National Convention. If you want to listen to it on the radio, in addition to watching it on television, you can do both. Our coverage will start tonight at 7 o'clock, and it's a collaboration between NPR and PBS. So you'll hear a lot of NPR reporters. I was watching it last night, and PBS as well. Well done. Thanks for your calls.